During the darkness he had relinquished his hold upon life, and had departed. With the help of an old friend of his, we dug a grave and buried him. I wrapped what little food was left in a cloth, and with a stout stick to help me, I departed. A mile or so and I was exhausted. My legs shook and my head seemed to spin, making my vision blurry. For a time I lay by the side of the coast road, keeping out of sight of passers-by, for I had been warned that this was a dangerous district indeed for strangers. Here, I was told, a man could lose his life if his expression did not please the armed thugs who roamed at large terrorizing the district. Eventually I resumed my journey and made my way to Unki. My informants had given me very clear instructions on how to cross the border into Russian territory. My condition was bad, frequent rests were necessary, and on one such occasion I was sitting by the side of the road idly watching the heavy traffic. My eyes wandered from group to group until I was attracted to five Russian soldiers, heavily armed and with three huge mastiffs. For some reason, at the same time, one of the soldiers chanced to look at me. With a word to his companions he unleashed the three dogs which came towards me in a blow of speed, their snarling fangs slavering with fierce excitement. The soldiers started towards me, fingering their submachine guns. As the dogs came, I sent friendly thoughts to them. Animals had no fear or dislike of me. Suddenly they were upon me, tails wagging, licking and slobbering over me and nearly killing me with friendship, for I was very weak. A sharp command, and the dogs cowered at the feet of the soldiers, now standing over me. "Ah," said the corporal in charge, "you must be a good Russian and a native here, otherwise the dogs would have torn you to pieces. They are trained for just that. Watch a while and you will see." They walked away, dragging the reluctant dogs, who wanted to stay with me. A few minutes later the dogs leapt urgently to their feet and dashed off to the undergrowth at the side of the road. There were horrible screams suddenly choked off by frothy bubbling, a rustling behind me, and as I turned, a bloody hand, bitten off at the wrist, was dropped at my feet while the dog stood there wagging his tail. "Comrade," said the corporal, strolling over, "you must be loyal indeed for Serge to do that. We are going to our base at Graskino. You are on the move. Do you want to ride that far with five dead bodies?"
"Yes, comrade corporal, I should be much obliged," I replied. Leading the way, with the dogs walking beside me wagging their tails, he took me to a half-track vehicle with a trailer attached. From one corner of the trailer a thin stream of blood ran to splash messily on the ground. Casually glancing in at the bodies piled there, he looked more intently at the feeble struggle of a dying man. Pulling out his revolver he shot him in the head, then reholstered his gun and walked off to the half-track without a backward glance. I was given a seat on the back of the half-track. The soldiers were in a good mood, boasting that no foreigner ever crossed the border when they were on duty, telling me that their platoon held the Red Star Award for competency. I told them that I was making my way to Vladivostok to see the great city for the first time, and hoping I would have no difficulty with the language. "Or," guffawed the corporal, "we have a supply truck going there tomorrow, taking these dogs for a rest, because with too much human blood they get too savage so that even we cannot handle them. You have a way with them. Look after them for us and we will take you to Vladi tomorrow. You understand us, you will be understood everywhere in this district. This is not Moscow." So I, a confirmed hater of communism, spent that night as a guest of the soldiers of the Russian Frontier Patrol. Wine, women and song were offered me, but I pleaded age and ill health. With a good plain meal inside me, the best for a long, long time, I went to bed on the floor, and slept with an untroubled conscience. In the morning we set out for Vladivostok. The corporal, one other rank, three dogs and me. And so, through the friendship of fierce animals, I got to Vladivostok without trouble, without walking, and with good food inside me. Chapter 3, The road was dusty and full of holes. As we drove along we passed gangs of women in the charge of an armed overseer, filling up the deepest of the holes with stones and with anything at hand. As we passed, the soldiers with me yelled ribald remarks and made suggestive gestures. We passed through a populated district and on until we came to grim buildings which must have been a prison. The half-track swept on and into a cobbled courtyard. No one was in sight. The men looked about in consternation. Then, as the driver switched off the engine, we became immediately aware of a tremendous clamor, the shouting of men and the fierce barking of dogs. We hurried towards the source of the sound, I with the soldiers. Passing through an open door set in a high stone wall, we saw a strong fenced enclosure which seemed to contain about 50 huge mastiffs. Quickly, a man on the edge of the crowd of soldiers outside the enclosure gabbled out his story. The dogs, with human bloodlust upon them, had got out of hand and had killed and devoured two of their keepers. A sudden commotion, and as the crowd shifted and swayed, I saw a third man, clinging high up on the wire fence, lose his grip on the wire and fell among the dogs. There was a horrid scream, a really blood-chilling sound, and then nothing but a snarling mass of dogs. The corporal turned to me, "Hey, you. You can control dogs." Then, turning to a soldier beside him, "Ask the comrade captain to come this way, say we have a man here who can control dogs." As the soldier hurried off, I nearly fainted with fright on the spot. Me? Why always me for the difficulties and dangers? Then as I looked at the dogs I thought, why not? These animals are not so fierce as Tibetan mastiffs, and these soldiers smell of fear to the dogs, and so the dogs attack. An arrogant looking captain strode through the crowd, which parted respectfully before him. Stopping a few feet from me, he looked me up and down, and a disdainful sneer passed over his face. "For, corporal," he said haughtily, "what have we here? An ignorant native priest." "Comrade captain," said the corporal, "this man was not attacked by our dogs. Serge bit off the hand of a frontier crosser and gave it to him. Send him into the enclosure, comrade captain." The captain frowned, shuffled his feet in the dust, and industriously bit his nails. At last he looked up. "Yes, I will do it," he said. "Moscow said that I must not shoot any more dogs, but they did not tell me what to do when the dogs had the bloodlust. This man, if he is killed, well, it was an accident. If he should live, though very unlikely, we will reward him." He turned and faced about, then stood looking at the dogs gnawing at the bones of the three keepers whom they had killed and eaten. Turning to the corporal, he said, "See to it, corporal, and if he succeeds, you are a sergeant." With that he hastened away. For a time the corporal stood wide-eyed. "Me, a sergeant? Man," he said, turning to me, "you tame the dogs and every man of the frontier patrol will be your friend. Get in." "Comrade corporal," I replied, "I should like the other three dogs to go in with me, they know me and they know these dogs." "So it shall be," he answered, "come with me and we will get them." We turned and went out to the trailer of the half-track. I fondled the three dogs, letting them lick me, letting them put their smell on me. Then, with the three dogs jostling and bounding around me, I went to the barred entrance of the enclosure. Armed guards stood by in case any dog escaped. Quickly the gate was opened a trifle, and I was roughly thrust inside. Dogs rushed at me from everywhere. The snapping jaws of my three discouraged most from coming too close to me, but one huge, ferocious beast, obviously the leader, sprang murderously at my throat. For that I was well prepared, and as I stepped aside I gave him a quick thrust in the throat, a judo, or karate as people now term it, thrust which killed him before he touched the ground. The body was covered with a seething, struggling mass of dogs almost before I could jump out of the way. The snarling and snapping noises were hideous. For a few moments I waited, unarmed, defenseless, thinking only kind and friendly thoughts towards the dogs, telling them by thought that I was not afraid of them, that I was their master. Then they turned, and I had a moment of revulsion as I saw the bare skeleton of what had moments ago been the leader. The dogs turned towards me. I sat upon the ground and willed them to do the same. They crouched before me, in a half circle, paws outstretched, grinning, tongues lolling lazily, and tails sweeping from side to side. I stood up, and called Serge to my side. Putting my hand on his head, I said loudly, "From now on, you, Serge, will be leader of all these dogs, and you will obey me and will see that they obey me." From outside the enclosure came a spontaneous roar of applause. I had forgotten all about the soldiers. As I turned, I saw that they were waving their hands in friendship. The captain, his face suffused with excitement, came close to the wire and yelled, "Bring out the bodies of the keepers or their skeletons." Grimly I walked to the first body, a shredded, bloody mass, with the chest bones bare of flesh. I took it by an arm and pulled, but the arm came off at the shoulder. Then I pulled the man by the head, with his entrails dragging along behind. There was a gasp of horror, and I saw that Serge was walking beside me, carrying the man's arm. Laboriously I removed all three bodies, or what was left of them. Then, really exhausted with the strain, I stepped to the gate and was let out. The captain stood before me. "You stink," he said. "Get cleaned of the filth of those bodies. You shall remain here for a month looking after the dogs. After a month they return to their patrols and you can go. You shall have the pay of a corporal." He turned to the corporal and said, "As promised, you are now a sergeant from this moment." He turned and walked away, obviously quite delighted with the whole affair. The sergeant beamed upon me. "You are a magic maker. Never will I forget how you killed that dog. Never will I forget the sight of the captain hopping from foot to foot filming the whole affair. You have done a big thing for yourself. Last time we had a dog riot we lost 6 men and 40 dogs." Moscow came down heavy on the captain's neck. Told him what would happen if he lost any more dogs. "He will treat you good. You mess in with us now. We don't ask questions. But come, you stink, as the captain said. Wash off all that filth. I always told André he ate too much and smelled bad. Now I have seen him in pieces, I know I was right." I was so tired, so exhausted, that even such macabre humor as this did not shock me. A group of men, corporals, in the mess hall, guffawed loudly and said something to the sergeant. He roared, and hastened over to me. "Whore, whore, comrade priest," he bellowed, eyes streaming with mirth. "They say that you have so much of André's inside on your outside that you should have all his possessions now he is dead. He has no relatives. We are going to call you Comrade Corporal André for as long as you are here. All that was his is now yours. And you won me many rubles when I bet on you in the enclosure. You are my friend." Sergeant Boris was quite a good fellow at heart. Uncouth, rude in manner, and without any pretense of education, he still showed much friendship to me for securing his promotion. "I would have been a corporal all my life else," he said, "and for the large number of rubles he had won on me." A number of men had been saying that I had not a chance in the dog enclosure. Boris had heard, and said, "My man is good. You should have seen him when we set the dogs on him. Didn't move. Sat like a statue. The dogs thought he was one of them. He will get that crowd straightened out. You'll see. Bet on it, Boris," cried one man. "Take you 3 months to pay," said Boris. As a direct outcome, he had won about 3.5 years' pay and was grateful. That night, after a very ample supper, for the border patrol men lived well, I slept in a warm hut by the side of the dog enclosure. The mattress was well stuffed with dried esparto grass, and the men had obtained new blankets for me. I had every reason to be grateful for the training which gave me such an understanding of animals' nature. At first light I was dressed and went to see the dogs. I had been shown where their food was kept, and now I saw that they had a very good feed indeed. They clustered around me, tails awag, and every so often one would rear up and put his paws on my shoulders. At one such time I happened to look around, and there was the captain, outside of the wire of course, looking on. "Ah, priest," he said, "I merely came to see why the dogs were so quiet. Feeding time was a time of madness and fights, with the keeper standing outside and throwing food in, with the dogs staring at each other to get their share. I will ask you no questions, priest. Give me your word to remain here for 4 to 5 weeks until the dogs all move out and you can have the run of the place and go to the city when you want to." "Comrade captain," I replied, "I will gladly give you my word to remain here until all these dogs leave. Then I will be on my way." "Another matter, priest," said the captain. "At the next feeding time I will bring my sign camera and take a film so that the superiors can see how we keep our dogs in order. Go to the quartermaster and draw a new corporal's uniform, and if you can find anyone to help you in the enclosure, get them to clean it thoroughly. If they are afraid, do it yourself.
I will do it myself, comrade captain, I replied, then the dogs will not be upset.
The captain nodded curtly, and marched off, obviously a very happy man that he could now show how he managed the blood-lusting dogs. For 3 days I did not move more than 100 yards from the dog enclosure. These men were trigger-happy and thought nothing of shooting into the bushes in case there should be spies hiding, as they put it. For 3 days I rested, regaining my strength, and mixing with the men. Getting to know them, getting to know their habits. Andre had been much the same size as me, so his clothes fitted reasonably well. Everything of his had to be washed and washed again, though, because he had not been noted for cleanliness. Many times the captain approached me, trying to engage me in conversation, but while he seemed genuinely interested and friendly enough, I had to remember my role of a simple priest who merely understood the Buddhist scriptures and dogs. He would sneer at religion, saying that there was no afterlife, no God, nothing but Father Stalin. I would quote scriptures, never exceeding the knowledge that a poor village priest could be expected to have. At one such discussion, Boris was present, leaning up against the dog compound idly chewing a sliver of grass. "Sergeant," exclaimed the captain in exasperation, "the priest has never been out of his little village. Take him around and show him the city. Take him on patrol to Artem and Terezdolno. Show him life. He only knows about death, thinking that that is life." He spat on the ground, lit a contraband cigarette, and stalked away. "Yes, come on, priest, you have stayed with the dogs so long you are beginning to look like them. Though I must admit that you have them well behaved now. And you did win for me a pile of money. I float on air with it, priest, and must spend it before I die." He led the way to a car, got in, and motioned for me to do the same. He started the engine, moved the gear lever, and let in the clutch. Off we went, bouncing on the rutted roads, roaring into the narrow streets of Vladivostok. Down by the harbor there were many ships, almost more ships than I had known existed in the world. "Look, priest," said Boris, "those ships have captured goods. Goods which were going to be lent lease from the Americans to some other country. They think the Japanese captured them, but we ship the cargoes over the railway, the Trans-Siberian Railway, back to Moscow where the party bosses have what they think is first pick. We have first pick because we have an arrangement with the docks. We turn a blind eye on their doings, while they turn a blind eye on ours. Have you ever had a watch, priest?" "No," I replied, "I have owned very little in my life. I know the time by the position of the sun and the shadows. You must have a watch, priest." Boris speeded up the car and shortly we drew alongside a freighter moored to the dock side. The ship was streaked with red rust and sparkling with dried salt spray. The journey round the Golden Horn had been a hard and rough one. Cranes were swinging their long jibs, unloading the produce from different parts of the world. Men were shouting, gesticulating, manipulating cargo nets, and pulling on hawsers. Boris jumped out, dragging me with him, and rushed madly up the gangplank, still with me in tow. "We want watches, Cap'n," he bawled at the first man in uniform. "Watches, for the arm." A man with a more ornate uniform than the others appeared and motioned us to his cabin. "Watches, Cap'n," bawled Boris. "One for him and two for me. You want to come ashore, Cap'n? Good time ashore. Do what you like. Girls, get drunk, we not interfere. We want watches." The captain smiled, and poured drinks. Boris drank his noisily, and I passed mine to him. "He no drink, Cap'n, he a priest turned dog watcher, good dog watcher, too, good fellow," said Boris. The captain went to a space beneath his bunk and drew out a box. Opening it, he displayed perhaps a dozen wrist watches. Almost quicker than the eye could see, Boris picked 2 gold ones, and without bothering to wind them, slipped one on each arm. "Take a watch, priest," commanded Boris. I reached out and took a chromium one. "This is a better one, priest," said the captain. "This is a stainless steel, waterproof Omega, a far better watch." "Thank you, captain," I replied, if you have no objection, I will have the one of your choice. Now I know you are crazed, priest, said Boris, a steel watch when you can have gold? I laughed and replied, steel is good enough for me, you are a sergeant, but I am only a very temporary corporal. From the ship we went to the Trans-Siberian Railroad sidings. Work gangs were busily loading the trucks with the choicest goods from the ships. From here the trucks would leave for Moscow, some 6,000 miles away. As we stood there, one train moved out, to engines pulling a vast array of railroad cars, each engine with five wheels on each side. Giant things which were well kept and which were regarded almost as living creatures by the train crew. Boris drove along beside the tracks. Guards were everywhere, from pits in the ground armed men scanned the undersides of the passing trains, looking for stowaways. You seem to be very afraid of anyone illegally riding the trains, I said. This is a thing which I do not understand. What harm could it do to allow people to take a ride? Priest, sadly replied Boris, you have no knowledge of life, just as the captain said. Enemies of the party, saboteurs, and capitalist spies would try to steal into our cities. No honest Russian would want to travel unless so directed by his commissar. But are there many trying to take rides? What do you do with them when you see them? Do with them? Why, shoot them, of course. Not many stowaways just here, but tomorrow I am going to Atom and I will take you. There you will see how we deal with such subversive elements. The train crews, when they catch one, tie his hands, slip a rope round his neck, and throw him off. Makes a mess of the track, though, and encourages the wolves. Boris slumped in the driving seat, his eyes scanning the packed railroad cars trundling along. As if electrified, he sat bolt upright and jabbed the accelerator right down. The car leapt ahead and raced past the head of the train. Slamming on the brakes, Boris jumped out, grabbed his submachine gun, and hid by the side of the car. Slowly the train rumbled by. I caught a glimpse of someone riding between two railroad coaches, and then there was the stuttering stammer of the submachine gun. The body tumbled to the ground between the tracks. Got him, said Boris triumphantly, as he carefully cut another nick in the stock of his gun. That makes 53, priest, 53 enemies of the state accounted for. I turned away, sick at heart, and afraid to show it, for Boris would have shot me as easily as he had shot the man if he had known that I was not the village priest. The train passed on, and Boris walked to the riddled, bleeding body. Turning it over with his foot he looked at the face, and said, I recognize this as a railroad worker. He should not have been riding. Perhaps I should blow off his face so there will be no difficult questions. So saying, he put the muzzle of the gun near the face of the dead man and pulled the trigger. Leaving the now headless corpse, he returned to the car and we drove away. I have never been on a train, Boris, I said. Well, he replied, tomorrow we will go to Atom by goods train and you can look around. I have some good friends there I want to meet now that I am a sergeant. For long I had cherished the idea of stowing away aboard some ship and steaming off to America. I mentioned ship stowaways to Boris. Boris, I said, you spend all your time stopping people at the frontier and making sure there are no stowaways on the trains. Yet all these ships, anyone could walk aboard and stay. Boris leaned back and roared with laughter. Priest, he guffawed, you must be a simpleton. The water guards board the ships a mile from the shore and they check all members of the crew. Then they seal all hatches and ventilators, and pour cyanide gas into the holds and other spaces, not forgetting the lifeboats. They get a good bag of stiffs from reactionaries who do not know about this. I felt very sick at the callous manner in which these men treated the whole affair as sport, and I hastily changed my mind about stowing aboard ship. Here I was in Vladivostok, but I had my allotted task in life, and as the prophecy had stated, I had to go first to America, then to England, and back to the North American continent. The problem was, how to get out of this part of the world. I determined to find out as much as possible about the Trans-Siberian Railway, where the checks and searches ended, and what happened at the Moscow end. The next day I exercised and fed the dogs early, and with them well settled, I set out with Boris and three other guards. We traveled some 50 miles to an outpost where the 3 guards were to replace 3 others. All the way the men were chatting about how many escapees they had shot, and I picked up some useful information. I learned the point at which there were no more checks. I learned that if one was careful, one could travel to the outskirts of Moscow without being caught. Money was going to be the problem, that I could see. I made money by standing duty for other men, by treating their ills, and through the good offices of some of them, treating wealthy party members in the city itself. Like others, I arranged to visit ships, and took my share of the spoils of new train loads. All my bounty was turned into rubles. I was preparing to cross Russia. Nearly 5 weeks later, the captain told me that the dogs were now going back to their patrol stations. A new commissar was coming, and I must leave before he arrived. Where was I going? He asked. Knowing my man by now, I replied, I will remain in Vladivostok, comrade captain. I like it here. His face grew apprehensive. You must leave, get right out of the district. Tomorrow. But comrade captain, I have nowhere to go, and no money. I answered. You shall be given rubles, food, clothing, and taken out of this district. Comrade captain, I reiterated, I have nowhere to go. I have worked hard here, and I want to stay in Vladivostok. The captain was adamant. Tomorrow we send men to the very limit of our area, to the boundary of Voroshilov. You shall be taken there and left. I will give you a letter saying that you have helped us and you have gone there with our permission. Then the Voroshilov police will not arrest you. This was far better than I had hoped. I wanted to get to Voroshilov, because that was where I intended to board the train. I knew that if I could get to the other side of that city, I should be fairly safe. The next day, with a number of other men, I climbed aboard a fast troop carrier and we roared up the road on the way to Voroshilov. This time I was wearing a good suit of clothes, and had a large rucksack stuffed with belongings. I also had a shoulder bag full of food. It gave me not a qualm to remember that the clothes I wore had been taken from a dead ship jumper. Don't know where you are going, priest, said Boris, but the captain has said that he trained those dogs, so you had to leave. You can sleep at the outpost tonight, and be on your way in the morning. That night I was unsettled. I was sick and tired of roaming from place to place. Sick and tired of living with death nudging my elbow. It was utterly lonely living with these people who were so alien, so absolutely opposed to my peaceful way of living. In the morning, after a good breakfast, I said goodbye to Boris and the others, shouldered my load, and set off. Mile after mile I covered, avoiding the main road, trying to circle Voroshilov. There was the roar of a speeding car behind me, the squeal of hastily applied brakes, and I found myself looking down the muzzle of a submachine gun. Who are you? Where are you going? Snarled a scowling corporal. I am on my way to Voroshilov, I replied. I have a letter here from comrade Captain Vasily. Snatching the letter from me, he tore it open, frowning in the concentration of reading. Then his face broke into a broad grin. We have just come from Sergeant Boris, he said. Get in, we will drive you to Voroshilov and let you off where you say. This was a nuisance. I was trying to avoid the city. But I climbed into the patrol car and was speedily driven to Voroshilov. I alighted near the police headquarters, and as the car shot off into the garage, I walked smartly along, trying to cover as many miles as possible before nightfall. I planned to camp out near the railroad and observe what happened for a night and day before climbing aboard. Passenger trains were stopped and checked at the Voroshilov, but the goods trains stopped just outside, possibly so that the local people should not see how many stowaways were killed. I watched and watched, and decided that my only hope was to get on a train just as it was pulling out. On the night of the second day, a very desirable train stopped. A train which my experience told me had many lend-lease cargoes aboard. This was not one to be missed, I thought, as I eased myself along the tracks, peering under, testing locked doors, opening those which were not locked. Every now and then a shot rang out, followed by the thud of a falling body. Dogs were not used here for fear that they would be killed by the wheels. I rolled in the dust, making myself as dirty as possible. The guards came by, peering at the train, shouting to each other, flashing powerful lamps. No one thought to look behind the train, and the train only engaged their attention.